This is music from Nate Smith. Welcome to The Checkout. It's also a podcast. You should probably know that by now. Subscribe to it today on iTunes. I'm Simon Rentner. Nate Smith might be an average generic name, but there's really nothing average or generic about him. Nate Smith happens to be one of the most respected names in jazz today. And that was inscribed at a very early age. First, when the legendary singer Betty Carter recruited him, and then a little later, linking up with the famous Dave Holland Quintet. From there, he could pretty much dictate whatever he wanted to do in music. And today, that's releasing his very first album as a bandleader in his own name. Nate Smith joins us to talk about it. Kinfolk, Postcards from Everywhere. This is The Checkout. Thanks for checking in. Nate Smith, one of the baddest drummers, at least for my money.
Thank you, man.
Maybe in New York City, perhaps the world.
Thank you, bro.
Has provided the pulse behind artists such as Robbie Coltrane, Chris Potter, Jose James, and now NEA Jazz Master Dave Holland many years.
My man.
But now he is stepping out from behind the kit, toiling on his own album for more than 3 years.
Toiling, baby. Toiling.
Kinfolk, Postcards from Everywhere. It gives me great pleasure to welcome Nate Smith to The Checkout.
Thank you, man. Thank you, brother. It's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you for that introduction. That's all right. I feel official, baby. Yeah.
Totally. Well, I mean, we just heard Small Moves Interlude, just to give you a little taste of how bad your drumming is, because I'm sort of hearing multiple time signatures happening concurrently. It sounds like you're negotiating some left and right brain stuff with that tune.
Yeah, most of the time, most in life. But you know, it's funny, that tune is all in four. It's just I kind of displaced the beat so that it feels like it's shifting around. But it's all like in, you know, if you started from the top and you are counting it in four, it's all there. But it's kind of what the tune is about. Like the smallest shift can have the biggest impact, you know, so moving it one little 16th note off the grid can change the way it feels or change your perception of it, you know.
Now, cognitively, is that like juggling and doing a crossword puzzle at the same time? I mean, is it does it take practice to do that?
A little bit, but I think more than anything else, it's just about kind of relaxing when you play. That's the thing. It took me a long time, and it's a lifelong process of learning to relax when I play. And relaxing means sort of trusting the pulse, trusting your clock, trusting, you know, your time. And also kind of having the sort of sense of knowing of where the beat is, you know. So it's not, I do have to think about it. Sometimes there are some musical situations I'm in where I do have to think about the beat. And I do have to kind of, I try to avoid counting because sometimes when I count, I get lost. So, but I try to feel, I'm always thinking about some musical element that is my anchor point, you know, when I'm playing.
Now, time is such an elusive thing. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of, I don't know, it's either you have it or don't. It's sort of like people that have perfect pitch, people that have perfect time. Is that similar? And do you know any drummers that are amazing drummers but have horrible time?
You know what? Let me answer the first one first. I don't know that I've ever met anyone who has perfect time, nor do I believe I do. But I do think it's you can have really good relative time, like in terms of thinking of the distance between one beat and the next beat. Some people have a really good sense of that, and some people don't have as strong a sense of it.
I mean, I don't think. Well, I don't even know what relative time means. What do you mean by relative time?
Like, okay, so if you're thinking about events on a grid. Let's say you're looking at, a ruler, right? And so you're looking at
or a metronome.
A metronome. So let's think about that. So let's start with that. A metronome that's ticking one beat per or two beats per second. That's 120 beats a minute.
Robotically precisely.
Right. Okay. So thankfully, robots and humans play sound different. So there are some musicians who have a closer relationship between the beat, closer to the metronome than others. But and there's but that doesn't mean that they necessarily have great time. It just means that they probably play in time. I mean, having great time and playing in time are kind of two different things, I think. Like, you know, there are some musicians who redefine time when they play. They stretch time and they kind of, you know, they perform quantum physics with time. I think Elvin Jones did that. Elvin Jones sort of redefined time. Jack DeJohnette does that. You know, Andrew Cyril does that. Like, they kind of redefine. Whereas a drummer like, you know, Bernard Purdy or a drummer like Steve Gadd or Omar Hakim, it's a little more about, like, kind of being in that space where the time is really even and they can play, but they still make it feel alive, you know? They're playing it sort of on a grid or to a click or to a metronome or whatever, and it feels so solid and so grounded, but there's still life in between the beats, you know? So that's kind of my idea about relative time, like one event relative to the next.
Well, let's get on the Bernard Purdy tip, but with Nate Smith and his recording, maybe indirectly got some Purdy in bounce points one and two, at least in the concepts that you're talking about.
Sure, absolutely.
Because you can't help but nod your head to this.
This is it. This is one of those things where you feel a propulsion from one beat to the next, hopefully.
Nate Smith, are you a good dancer?
No, I don't dance at all. I can two-step, you know, I got a real nice two-step, but I'm not the guy who's in the middle of the floor. Like, I'm not that guy. I'm not that dude.
Because there's definitely a kinetic energy to this song.
Yeah, there is.
You can't, like I said, you almost have to move in some way, even if it's just a head nod.
Absolutely. And that's the aim, is like you want people to actually feel something pulling them, you know, when, you know, that tension between beats, that sort of feeling of life in between the beats is what makes people move. They hear one sound and then it's like, where's the next one? Oh, where's the next sound? Oh, here it comes. And your body reacts to that, you know? So I, you know, again, I let dancers dance. I play the drums. I'm not a dancer by any stretch.
We're listening to Kinfolk, Postcards from Everywhere, new music by the drummer Nate Smith, his debut recording on Rope-A-Dope. We just heard Bounce 1 and 2. In the top of the press release, I can't help but ignore this very strong statement of yours, mm-hmm. that you are basically chronicling your own Black experience mm-hmm. and reality of the American dream through deep-rooted grooves. Mm. What does the American dream mean to you? Mm. Are you living the American dream?
I believe I am. I really believe I am. I am a musician. I'm an artist. I do what I love. I feel very free to do what I love to do. I feel really grateful to do it.
And perhaps you're the first generation, at least from your family and lineage, to not have the burden of being a Black man.
Absolutely.
Right?
Well, I mean, the burden of being a Black man.
Well, yeah, that always persists, of course.
It does.
But in sense of realizing your American dream.
Right. I don't think that at this point it's as obvious or as explicit a hindrance toward that. There are still, you know, people who will think the worst about people of color, Black folks, Latino folks, whatever. I think those people will always exist, unfortunately. And until we actually have a conversation about what that is and why that is. But for me, I mean, the American dream, I feel like I'm living it. I feel like I'm very blessed to live it. I feel exceedingly grateful. And I feel like I'm able to live it because of my parents, my family, and the work they did and the sacrifices they made. And, you know, I feel very privileged to have been born into that lineage and to have, you know, benefited from that.
Well, let's go into that mm-hmm. history a little bit. This is you talking to your father, mm-hmm. talking about his father.
Right.
And let's listen to this right now.
Peter, Joe, and Mildred. All right, Mildred Ross.
All right.
Danny was a civil servant for most of his working life.
Okay.
He worked in the shipyard for a while. Mm-hmm. Then he was accepted by the government as a civil servant down at the Naval Air Station.
Okay.
Yeah. His electro played a helper, and then they never promoted him.
Wow.
Until Bob Melvin got in it.
Right. And made a fuss.
Yeah, made a fuss. Mm-hmm. And worked all his life.
Yeah.
You know, he delivered, he cut corn in the field. He did a lot of things like that.
Yeah.
But the first job he had was civil service.
Civil service.
And they were paying him helper's wages. Couldn't do much, mm-hmm. and wasn't allowed to do much.
Right.
But he worked all his life. Mm-hmm.
Basically, your grandfather was exploited his whole life mm-hmm. for being a Black man mm-hmm. in Jim Crow South, mm-hmm. and worked his whole life and basically never got very little.
He didn't get what he deserved. He didn't get what he earned, commensurate with people that were less talented than him, less, you know, skilled than he was. And I think, you know, there was a real...
Well, what did he do, first of all?
Well, he was a civil servant. He worked as an electroplater. I think what he did was he was welding for the shipyard in Norfolk, Virginia. And he always had a talent. He was a very handy guy. He built his home. He would take these correspondence classes where he would learn about like electronics through these like kind of these mail pamphlets he'd get, and he would work on building clocks and repairing radios, and he just had a real fascination with gadgets, you know, and this is something I learned from my dad talking to him about it, and you know, he would train these younger white guys to do what he was doing, and they would get promoted past him because of the way the system worked, and they never would promote him. So my dad alludes to my uncle Melvin, who was a very outspoken man, a very gregarious fellow. And there's a story that, you know, my uncle Melvin went to the shipyard and talked to my dad's boss and said, you know, this guy's been here for a while, gave him a firm talking to, and eventually he was promoted, you know. But I think because of the life he provided for my dad and my uncle was emboldened to do that, to go talk to him and say, look, this is not fair. I think that's kind of a heroic sacrifice on the part of my grandfather to do that, to know that, you know. I think that is worthy of some celebration, you know.
Well, let's celebrate mm-hmm. your grandfather mm-hmm. with your tune, Home Free, mm-hmm. for Peter Joe. That's Home Free for Peter Joe. We're speaking to Nate Smith. Here he's honoring the legacy of his family and, most importantly, his grandfather. It's kind of amazing. I mean, that's sort of the ideal for any parent. You always want the next generation to be better than the last, which is kind of interesting in the state that we're in today.
It really is.
Because, you know.
Yeah. It does. It's not shaping up that way, unfortunately. I think there are a lot of reasons that could be a much different thread of conversation. But I will say, again, I know how hard my parents worked. And I know the things that the dreams they deferred so that we could do the things that we want to do. And I feel exceedingly grateful for that. So I do feel like I've taken a step further in terms of my freedom to express myself and be myself than they could have, you know.
Well, let's go to that Virginia street where you grew up on Allison Drive. This is Morning in Allison. We're speaking with Nate Smith and his recording, Kinfolk, Postcards from Everywhere.
Do you pronounce the L in kinfolk? Is it folk, yeah, folk or folk?
Folk, no, kinfolk.
Folk,
put
folk.
The L.
You,
the L
you
in
even
it.
Ignore the K.
Yeah, kinfolk, man. It's get
kinfolk.
Kinfolk. That's it. That's it. Put that. Put it all in. And I feel
that's
like
a southern thing, right?
It is a southern thing. So the one of the neighboring towns I grew up in is Norfolk, Virginia. But there are a lot of pronunciations of Norfolk. People say Norfolk, Norfolk. Norfolk, Norfolk. You don't hear any O's in the Norfolk. You know that people say that, and it is a southern thing. It's you know where I'm from. You know,
if we turn this to music, mm-hmm. is there a dialect or rhythm musically mm-hmm. that southerners appreciate more? Because on that last tune we just heard, Allison Drive. Mm-hmm. Quite frankly, Chris Bowers sounds a lot like Robert Glasper, like halfway through that tune.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
and the beat is like very Houstonian.
It's funny, you know, Chris is from L.A. And, you know, I don't know the ins and outs of his family history, but I do know that there is a beautiful sophistication around Chris's playing. I really love. And he's so young. The thing about him, Just for a second, I don't want to go on too long of a tangent about it, but there's this real kind of old soul in Chris, and
even the way he buttons up his shirts,
even the way man, the style, it starts there, right? It starts with the style. My man is always clean, but no, I think that there is a real a real sophistication in the way he plays, a musical sophistication in the way he writes. So he has enough language and vocabulary to adapt to any musical situation. So if there are echoes of Houston or echoes of even Dilla or even, you know, stuff in that realm, actually when I was making this record, I was thinking a lot of, Starfish and Coffee. That's on the Sign of the Times album. Sign of the Times was a big deal to me when I was growing up. I discovered it like 1989, 1990 or so. And I watched that concert movie. I listened to that record over and over and over. I memorized every note of that live show. That's actually my favorite period of Prince. Like Sheila E. on drums, Eric Leeds, and I think the guy's name was Atlanta Bliss on horns. And it was like a jazzier era. Claire Fisher did a lot of string arrangements during that time for him. Like it felt like a much more open kind of a jazzier era for him. Starfish and coffee. Maple syrup and jam, butterscotch clouds and a tangerine, a side order of ham. If you set your mind free, baby, maybe you understand. Starfish and coffee, maple syrup and jam. There's another song by D'Angelo called Africa, which is on the Voodoo album. And if there is any degenerate hip-hop, R&B, Dilla information in Morning and Allison, it's coming from that drum beat. That snares off, playing that boom bap. That is a direct lineage to that. And sort of a salute to it. A fellow Virginian, by the way, D'Angelo. Sometimes we forget he's from Richmond, but he is definitely from Richmond.
What makes him absolutely Richmond?
Right.
And we're speaking for you too.
Sure, of course.
So, of course. You are D'Angelo too in this sense.
In this sense, I feel like we're kind of from the same soil, you know, in a lot of ways. I've never met the brother, don't know him, but I feel like we have a lot of things in common musically. I feel like there is a certain feeling or a certain tempo that sits really, really well when you hear like Virginia guys play it. I feel like there's a young guy named Corey Fonville who's a good friend of mine. He's in a band called Butcher Brown. Butcher Brown is a great band, and I feel like they really sound like Richmond. You know, there's a pace. There's almost a drawl in the music. There's like the way how delayed they play the time, how loose and lazy it feels sometimes. But it's still in the pocket. Like there's still this very, very strong pulse moving through the music.
Let's get down and dirty with the skip step. This is this reminds me of, now I hear the Prince influence mm-hmm. with this kind of music.
Absolutely.
Or at least the rock.
Yeah, absolutely. There are those sonic elements there. But also, you know, I feel like a lot of this music is a mashup of everything I heard floating through my house as a kid. Beginning with my father's record collection. His record collection is kind of what got me into this mess because I was so fascinated with the sounds.
Now, you say that the Jazz Crusaders, Grover Washington Jr., mm-hmm. Bob James, mm-hmm. David Sanborn mm-hmm. were all on heavy rotation. What was the song that maybe was waxed the most?
Mm. He loved Quincy Jones records. The Dude album. He played that record all the time. He played Quincy Jones, The Dude, all the time. He played, I Know Carita. That was the record. He played that record all the time. And it was that rhythm section, that sound. He always used to say he loved the way Quincy Jones records made his stereo sound. Because Quincy Jones records were so beautifully produced and so beautifully mixed that he would put them on and he was like, man, it sounds so full. He would just be like, he'd be amazed. And he would play these records over and over. I love those records. There was something about those grooves, about the way those guys were playing, about how huge the sound was. If I had to choose one record that sums up like my memory of my dad in his man cave playing his records, that's the record.
Quincy Jones.
Yeah.
We're speaking with Nate Smith and what he was listening to as a child.
Absolutely.
And now he has a statement of his own mm-hmm. on Rope-A-Dope. I love this like call back and forth. You grew up in the church too? This call and response just comes natural to
Man,
you?
Man, you know, my church, it's interesting. I did not grow up in the Pentecostal church, like the Baptist church, but I was in church every Sunday. We were an AME church, so African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church, right? And you have to Wikipedia. I really don't even know what it means. All I know is that it kept me really busy as a kid. My mom loved church. She still does. She does a lot of stuff for the church. She's in all the boards. She's like, you know. And every Saturday and Sunday, I was in church all weekend. And my first gig was at church. We didn't have drums every Sunday. My pastor was not that kind of a pastor. So, but when the drums came out, it was a special occasion. It was a concert or it was a you know, like a special presentation of something, or a revival or something. So that's when the drums would come out. And my first gigs back in 87, 88, were playing with my mother's choir at church.
Well, let's listen to your mom. Your mom's even on this record, and here's a little excerpt of it.
He went to Detroit when he first got married.
Okay.
And I was born in Detroit.
Okay.
Steve was born in Detroit. Lewis was born in Detroit.
Mm.
Then he was drafted into the Army.
Okay.
And that's when Mom came back to Florida to stay with her mother.
Got it.
Uh-huh. And then he came back to, and she had bought a house in Salem.
Mm-hmm.
With a little bit of money he sent every month, she saved up enough to buy a house.
So her retracing her dad and Mom's steps as young people when they first got married, she talks about him joining the Army. She talks about him migrating to Detroit to find work. She talks about how he sent money home from the service and how my grandmother was able to cobble together enough for a down payment for a house. And just like the work they did, the thing that to build the family they built, that's really what I want to sort of honor with these interludes.
Maybe the biggest name on your album.
Yes.
He is an NEA Jazz Master 2017.
He is.
We're spinning down with Dave Holland.
That's right.
I love this story, the consummate professional that Dave Holland is.
Yeah.
Can you just tell this one more time?
Oh, this is great. So, you know, first of all, Dave, I approached him about playing on my record, and he was, you know, just very generous and very open-hearted. And I said, Dave, man, would you do it? He said, of course, man, of course. I'd love to do it. And so he comes, you know, we started our session at noon. I showed up around 10 with Brian Bender, who was an engineer, and we were setting up. Dave shows up at 11, 15 with his bass. He's the first musician there, aside from me. And he sets up and, yeah, man, all right, I'm just going to leave my bass here. You know, I'm going to go get a coffee. Anybody need to say, no, we're all good. We're good, Dave. So he comes back and he said, man, I took a look at your charts. I rewrote them because there's a few things that I wanted to sort of simplify. I was like, okay, great. And so he sets the charts up. We do one take of each tune. We talk it down. We talk down the form. We do one take of each tune. Dave nails it. And there's actually a section that I wrote before the session that no one had seen. And Dave sight reads it, of course. He plays it perfectly. Right, man, I've got it. Let me just play it. He plays it through and he gets it. He nails it. We go back to the listening room. We're listening back to the tunes. He says, you know, I've got one fix, man. I want to go in. And he gets the bass. He does the punch. And Brian is like, oh, Mr. Holland, would you like to hear that back? He's like, no, man, it's good. Let's move to the next one. And he knocks it out. He's one take Jake. He is, and I'm thinking to myself, oh, okay, that's a professional musician. That is a master musician. And, you know, I've known Dave for, I guess, 18 years now.
How many records have you made with him?
I did two records with Dave. I did Critical Mass with the quintet, and I did Pathways with the octet. And I guess three now, including this one that he appeared on. And I also met Chris Potter while playing with Dave, playing with the quintet. And that relationship obviously created or grew into other projects too. But yeah, I've known Dave a long time, and I started to think about what a big part of my story he is. So there was no way I could make a debut bandleader record and not ask him to be a part of it. So I feel grateful that he did.
And he sounds great. I mean, oh, man. Holy mackerel. Might be one of my favorite tunes on the record.
He's Dave Holland. You know what I mean? I mean, he sounds like Dave. And you know, it's funny because every bassist I play it for is like, that's Dave. Immediately they recognize his attack, his tone. Like there's something very special about and unique about his playing.
We're speaking with Nate Smith, and he's channeling all kinds of musical history in his recording. Kinfolk, Postcards from Everywhere. We hear music from his childhood, Grover Washington, Bob James, the Jazz Crusaders. We also hear some Prince in here. We hear some Michael Jackson. We hear some Fela Kuti from Nigerian High Life. And you also channel the UK rock band Stereolab.
Absolutely.
So give us one Stereolab tune. If you were to put in a time capsule, what would you want to play for people?
Oh, this tune, Spiracles, their original version of this tune is incredible. It is one of the happiest songs I've ever heard. There is something about the chord progression, the harmony, the cycle of harmony in the song. It feels like you're discovering something every time you hear it. It really is beautiful. And the way they orchestrate the record, it is by far my favorite Stereolab tune.
Well, we're hearing a little before and after Stereolab's Spiracles.
Spiracles.
Thank you so much, Nate Smith, for spending some time with us and sharing your debut recording on Ropadope, Kinfolk, Postcards from Everywhere.
Thank you, brother. Thank you, Simon. I appreciate it, man.